I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Aoife Fitzpatrick about her historical novel, The Red Bird Sings. Aoife is a native of Dublin, Ireland. Her debut novel won the Lucy Cavendish Fiction Prize in 2020. In this episode, we discuss the unbelievable true story that inspired her gothic novel, how her research trip to West Virginia helped her get the tone and the voice right of her novel, and why she applied for Arts Council funding. But first, here's Aoife with an excerpt from The Red Bird Sings.
On June 22nd, 1897, Miss Minnie Gross, recently graduated from the Lewisburg Female Institute, took her seat in the Greenbrier County Circuit Court. And in the shadow of the bench where Justice Joseph McWhorter presided, she set her hands to the stenotype machine. The temperature was holding above 90 degrees, the paper wilting as Miss Gross struck the keys, feeding the narrow roll toward the floor. Upon this cream pulp was the court's official record, the only evidence that the jury would be allowed to consider in the trial of Trout Shoe for the murder of his wife, Zona Heaster Shoe. This transcript was to make no mention of Mary Jane Heaster, mother of the victim, who rose from her seat in hatless dishevelment as the defendant took the stand. Dressed in full mourning, her percale unfashionably loose, she might have been painted stark upon the glowing summer air, the frock in blackened bone, the face and hands primed in grey, her expression uncommonly frank. Mr. Shue wore a fresh linen suit and a starched white shirt, both of which he had begged from his jailer, Constable Shawver. And with his mild gaze, resting on the jury, he made his plea. Not guilty.
Hi Aoife, welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, The Red Bird Sings.
Hi, Chloe. It's so very nice to meet you. We're just saying before we started how we're stable mates with Nell Andrew as our wonderful agent. And it's fantastic to meet you. And thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you for being here. So can you start by telling us what The Red Bird Sings is about?
The novel is historical fiction that is based on a true story. So it's set in 1897. And it's based on the story of a woman called Zona Heaster, who lived in a place called Meadow Bluff in West Virginia, which is obviously in the United States. And Zona, when she was about, not completely sure of her date of birth, but when she was about 24 years old, she married a man called Trout Shoe. So he was a blacksmith who was relatively new to the area. She would have known him for maybe about 3 months before they married. So it was relatively whirlwind romance, even for those days. But Zona was dead 3 months later, and Trout was to go on to be tried for her murder. So that's something that you know at the beginning of the novel, is that Trout Shoe is going to be accused of the murder of his young wife, Zona. But there was a very particular circumstance and this is part of the true story also, surrounding his indictment, which is that Zona's mother, who's called Mary Jane Heaster, claimed to have had visions after her daughter's death, saying that her daughter visited her to tell her the truth of what had happened, which was that her husband had killed her. So it went from a situation where Zona's death was considered to be perhaps of natural causes to a situation where her husband was on trial for her murder. So that's the basics. There are lots of spoilers, obviously, I could say about the true story. We won't go down that road, but they're the nuts and bolts. That's kind of the skeleton that the story hangs on. Yeah.
Mm. Where did you first hear about this story? Because it's completely extraordinary and it's not the sort of story that you hear very often. So where did you hear about it first?
It's not. I heard about it first, actually on a podcast. I remember where I was. I was just going for a walk in the park and it was a science podcast, I think, on the BBC. I'm going to say it was Alex Shaw, but I'm not sure who said it. And it was an On This Day feature where they were saying on this day in 1897, the particular thing happened that, again, would be a huge spoiler for the book. But they brought up this story about this woman named Mary Jane Heaster in Greenbrier County and some extraordinary lengths that she had gone to in pursuit of justice for her daughter, who she was convinced had been murdered. I think the story just really stuck with me. Because obviously superficially it has these very extraordinary elements that somebody saying they saw the daughter of their ghost and spoke to her and, you know, accused her husband of murder, like that is very extraordinary. I think what stuck with me most was imagining Mary Jane Heaster, who lived in the countryside quite a ways out of town, maybe an hour, you know, on a wagon to come into Lewisburg, which would be the nearest town where the Greenbrier County Circuit Court is. So there would have been a lot of jurists, a lot of lawyers around that town, a very formal environment, a lot of educated men, I guess. She didn't have a vote. She had no authority to speak really publicly, no cause to do it. So how did she find herself in a situation where she was so haunted by the need for justice for her daughter that she managed to navigate that environment? It just seemed extraordinary because it's quite, she had a pre-feminist existence, if that's even a term that we could talk about. She wouldn't have had any vocabulary, even in terms of suffragism or certainly in terms of her situation as a woman and the kind of life that she was leading. So there was no support in her community for this idea of how women might break out of the roles or the situations or the voicelessness that they might have had. So for her to have originated the actions that took place within the story just seemed absolutely extraordinary and something to not just write about, but that when you think about the story and the things that happened in terms of domestic homicide or domestic violence, there's really not very much that has changed. I mean, if you were to stand over Mary Jane's shoulder, stand behind her and look toward the future, really a lot of the shapes remain the same societally in terms of how women may be isolated in their homes, might be controlled by a partner, and where there may be incidences of controlled violence, you know, that might result in not just injury, but life-changing injury, or in the case of the book, really, is the theme of domestic homicide.
So I'd love if you could tell us a little bit more about two of your characters, and I'm thinking particularly of Zona's mother and her friend. Can you tell us about them and their relationship to Zona?
Mary Jane Heaster. So I mentioned Mary Jane at the start, that she was the first person that I had heard about when I heard about the story. Zona's mother, who... She's living in Meadowbluff in West Virginia, and she is a farmer's wife. They're blue collar land owners. So they're kind of, you know, people think about it when they ask me about the book, they kind of they're very poor, or they lived in poverty, but not really. I mean, I think they would have had a certain amount of money, but they also would have had, these particular people had a large enough farm that they would have been able to kind of barter. That she'd inherited 98 acres of land, I discovered in a newspaper not long before. So trying to put them in the context of a family who maybe had a small amount of means that had some hope for their daughter making maybe, you know, a half decent marriage to another farmer. So Mary Jane was not very happy by all accounts, real and fictional, when this blacksmith comes along. Perhaps it was in terms of how quickly they got married. I think one of the things that happened was that she fell out of touch with her family fairly quickly. I think almost immediately after she was married, she moved closer to the town and she just didn't see her very much. There was always some excuse, you know, for Zona not to see her mother or to see her family. So Mary Jane's way of handling things in the book, she's having difficulty with her marriage as well because she's very dedicated to her way of life and it finds it as noble as it actually is fair to say that farming is quite a noble life. But her husband is getting different ideas about modernity and about kind of his role, how he might kind of expand to be maybe an inventor. He sees himself as maybe an Edison type or, you know, like Tesla or Westinghouse or somebody. He's going to come up with some incredible invention for the farm that is going to make them lots of money and move them away from their current circumstances. But Mary Jane is quite resistant to that. Because what place is she going to have in it, really? So I think that begins to, because she can't play a public role in that, and she does love the life that she already has, difficult as it is. She kind of feels this cold wind of modernity coming in and starting to create fractures in her life. So I think even before anything happens to Zona, she's rebelling a little bit as much as she can against her confines, even in terms of the clothes that she wears, that she's just really doesn't want to be restricted by her corsetry anymore. Or she's thinking about a talent that she had when she was younger for spiritualism that she was very interested in. So Mary Jane begins to have just these ambitions, an ambition to have more attention, perhaps, not always in the most positive ways. So she's nurturing this interest that she has in spiritualism that really comes to fruition after Zona dies. So she's very haunted, I mean literally and figuratively, by the need for justice. I think it's one of those situations that you'll see in the novel that after Zona dies, there are many things that when you look back, you've got this 2020 hindsight about what they may have meant and comes to a point where, yeah, she needs to have this courage of her convictions in terms of whether she's going to pursue Trout in the way that she really believes that she should. Lucy then is a fictional character, but it seemed to make perfect sense that Zona would have lived in a context where she had female friends, you know, peers, people she might have been to school with, people that she knew in the community. And Lucy also, because she's not inside the family, she's able to observe things in a slightly more objective way. So Lucy, who lived quite close to Zona originally, her mother has quite an advantageous marriage to a jeweler in Lewisburg. So she's moved away maybe when she was about 12 years old, and she has a different kind of a life. She, I think, is quite bored with really how she's living because she's expected to be just a young lady and to enjoy maybe the luxuries and the money that they have and their nice house, but she's not really finding a lot of meaning in that. So what she would like to do really is become a journalist. She's quite inspired by, or would have been quite inspired by journalists like maybe Ida Tarbell. Who was one of the original muckrakers in America who wrote great. She wrote about the life of Lincoln and later wrote about the Standard Oil Company, about Rockefeller. So Lucy, I don't know, the jury's out maybe on how good a journalist she's ever going to be, but she certainly has the drive there that she wants to report on crime and, you know, politics and current affairs, but she's really just being encouraged to write about society and maybe fashion and some nice ladylike things, you know, not something that's going to put a woman in danger and be on a beat reporter. So these are her ambitions at the time that her best friend dies, and she discovers that she has the mettle to maybe do some investigation into what may have happened. I think she and Mary Jane also have different ideas about how to approach it. I think when something serious happens within a family or between friends, there can be a lot of conflict about how to approach the problem because there's so much at stake. And I think there is definitely conflict between Mary Jane and Lucy in terms of how they should really pursue justice for Zona, and I think in the end they both contribute in their own ways.
How do you make that decision then of how much is what you've learned from your research? And I'm going to ask you about your research in a bit because I know you went to West Virginia where your novel's set, but how do you make that decision then between imagination and fact and the kind of gaps in between? How did you decide kind of between what we were going to keep as the real thing and what you were going to invent yourself?
Yeah, it's a really good question, isn't it? I think I was lucky, maybe, in terms of the types of fragments that existed about this story were maybe snippets of dialogue, from the trial, very very tiny amounts maybe of Mary Jane's testimony that she gave some like a key piece of testimony. Some local histories that people had written looking into I guess where Trout was from, maybe when he had arrived there, bits and pieces about the family, what their backgrounds might have been, little snippets from the census. It was so fragmentary that what was left for me to do was to kind of pull it together with some fictional elements. And I think I approached it trying to use as little intervention as possible. So imagination in terms of the characters, obviously. Not too much imagination, I guess, in terms of the plot with this one, in terms of the overall plot, subplots maybe, but the overall progression of what happens, there are quite a lot of key pieces there. Like there's a lot of drama, genuinely gothic drama that emotionally driven that happened in the real story with this. So it was really to pick which of those where to place each of those to really dramatize it to best effect and to bring it the truth of the story, hopefully, in terms of the experiences that Zona and Mary Jane and the fictional Lucy would have had. But there's kind of even with historical fiction, you're looking for the inevitability in the story, maybe. So yes, this extraordinary thing happened, but why did it happen? Like every step along the way has to be leading to that point. So I think maybe that limits the amount of imagination that you need to have if you're focused on character and how that person came from this A to B to C to D to so that nothing except what happened in the end could possibly have happened. That was the main focus that probably gave the balance between the imaginary elements or the fictional elements and the true story and just some of the when you read the novel, you'll see that there are, it's probably hard to believe that some of the things in it actually did happen, but they did. That's maybe for another kind of a spoiler podcast, but yeah, some very extraordinary things really did happen. Yeah.
So tell us about your research trip then. How did you go about it? At what point did you think, okay, I've got my film now, and now I need to go home and write this book? Tell us about your research.
The research, yeah, I said my trip to West Virginia was amazing. I mean, it is staggeringly beautiful. I recommend that anybody would go in the fall. We were really lucky actually. We went quite late in November and we got the best of the color in the leaves. It is absolutely like staggering. There are so many trees there and so many beautiful drives through the trees and beautiful rivers and but the best place that I went when I was there was to the North House Museum, which is an old building, somewhat adapted in Lewisburg. And Lewisburg, like I was saying earlier, is the town where the courthouse is, which is still very much as it was at the time of the trial. The North House Museum is where the Greenbrier Historical Society work, and they have an amazing archive there. So they were brilliant to me in terms of just producing just materials that they thought that I would find useful. And one of the, this sounds staggeringly dull, but one of the most useful things that they gave me were the biennial and agricultural reports from the late 19th century. And actually, there's a lot of color in it because people were very serious about their farming and very serious about their community and about writing all of these kind of little color pieces about what was happening, the fairs and what kind of pigs, breeds of pig were new and what kind of apples you should buy. And that was It was an article, one of those that told me, okay, this is actually the tone of the kind of language I'm using. So if I feel like I've hit upon this, I feel like that I felt confident leaving there that I'd gotten those aspects of the book right. But also, a man came in when I was there who happened to bring some antiques that had been cleared out of, an attic in a house, that included a little tiny 19th century women's black jacket that I was able to handle. Hadn't been put into the museum yet. I was able to grab it and have a little feel of like what the homespun seams were like and what the fabric felt like, and the size of it was so tiny. And it was really helpful in thinking about Mary Jane, for example, that she's wearing a lot of black clothes in the book, and to her mourning wear, or her weeds, widow's weeds. And another man came in also and could see some of the research that I was doing. There's a picture, there's one photograph that is purported to be of Trout Shoe, the blacksmith, the accused. And he pointed to it and said he was married to somebody who was a descendant of Trout Shoe's, relatively distant at this point. But he said that that photograph, it's definitely not of Trout Shoe, that there is only one photograph of him in existence. And his mother kept it above her heart until the day that she died. I
Wow.
thought, well, that is a very interesting piece of information for a novelist. Thank you very much. That's the kind of background that Trout Shoe might have had. But yeah, it was amazing. And also, they had recently acquired lots of 19th century farm implements. So I was able to go and look at this collection and handle it and really get a sense of how bespoke, I guess, people's tools were and their lives were, that they made things and used things to suit them very exactly, even in terms of the kind of gloves that they might use for corn shucking, would be very specific to that person or to that family. And the idea of mass production or even kind of being able to repair or replace wouldn't have been a very big thing for the Heaster family, but it just told me a lot about how they lived and how important their belongings were to them, and how their particular household really would have been an expression of who they were in a way that we might not express in terms of like going out to shops buying things. Yeah, it was just very interesting to be immersed in the environment, very specific local information, and come away feeling quite confident about it.
How much had you written or planned before you went out there? Were you kind of going out there with a very strong sense of what you already knew, or did you go out there with the kind of the bare bones, I guess, of the story?
I went with a very strong sense of character, and I went with probably quite a lot of meat on the bones, but that changed over time. I think I was at the beginning of the MFA. I did an MFA in creative writing in UCD in 2018 and 2019. So I went to West Virginia at the start of that. And yeah, I mean, to begin with, I was experimenting with between five and seven different voices that I wasn't entirely set on what the structure would be or what characters would or would not be included in terms of having their own voices. And after going to West Virginia, I guess it was a combination of being there and coming back with so much information that I could apply, and kind of whittling everything down to being simpler, I guess, maybe than it was before, and finding a more direct line through the story and through character, because there were so many things that really kind of had to be included in terms of plot, things that had definitely happened. Trying to work around that, yes, I had a clearer idea through the masters and through the research that I did as to where I needed to pare back, I would say, to make it work.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So I want to talk about the Lucy Cavendish Prize, because in 2021, and I just wondered what it was that sparked you to enter the competition and how that competition changed your entire writing journey.
That was, I mean, I still can't believe, and you're saying you won the Lucy Cavendish Fiction Prize. Did I? I did. That just doesn't sound right. It just still seems kind of unbelievable. Yeah, I had finished my master's at that point, and I hadn't started submitting the novel. It wasn't really ready to submit. I was thinking maybe 3 to 6 months after that, I might start sending it out. But it seemed like a great deadline, and it seemed like a really good way. I think that's what competitions can be really good for, is just getting your head in a space where you have a piece of work that you're doing to a certain level for a certain date, and you're just putting it out there. You're also risking the rejection, so you're just kind of, you're building your work, and you're building your, I don't know what else, you're building your armor, your, I don't, or not, I don't know. You're just getting used to having your work out there and getting responses to it, good or bad. Calluses, will we say calluses? I don't know. So that was probably the main reason. I wasn't very hopeful when I entered it, because I had obviously read books that had won or been shortlisted for the prize before, and I just thought, absolutely, there's zero chance here, but, you know, a good exercise. So by the time I was longlisted and shortlisted and then won, I was just kind of shocked, to be honest. I still am. Probably the best part of the prize, they're great people at Lucy Cavendish College. I mean, they're incredibly passionate and committed to women's writing. They really are. I would love to be there for the deliberations that they have, you know, for their final panels. I'd say they're very intense and brilliant, and yeah, they've got present company excluded. You can see they have an incredible eye as well, can't you, for like the people that they've chosen over the years. They really do have an eye for talent. So there's the people at Lucy Cavendish College, and there's also the people that you meet through the prize, you know, whether that's kind of mostly on Twitter, I would say, but there's kind of a nice community around it too. And I think when you haven't been published yet, it's nice to connect with people in that kind of easy way and kind of talk, and just know that there are other people out there who are doing the same thing. I mean, this is to say everybody says the same thing about this, really, don't they, that it's just, writing is quite isolated. So it's isolating, because you do have the opportunities to connect with other people, but you can feel that you're just living in your own brain. You can even forget you have a body like half the time, because you're just sitting there doing your work, not talking to anybody else about it, having no outlet for it, really. And just starting to connect with people outside of that, I think, is a really important thing for, I don't know, for every aspect of your writing, really, your sanity, not least least of it.
I don't know the answer to this question, but I think I do. So when you won the Lucy Cavendish, I'm imagining that Nell was a judge and she selected you to, well, she offered to represent you at that point, or was there kind of separate conversations?
Well, I think Nell, Nell's with Rachel Mills Literary now. So I think that transition happened kind of during the course of the prize. So she wasn't a judge. I think maybe put me on the long list, or maybe it was part of the screening, but wasn't around for the rest of the prize. Yeah. So the conversation happened outside of the prize in the end. But it is great for people who enter the prize, I think, have a lot of access and opportunities. It definitely attracts attention. If somebody were going to enter the prize, I would say, yeah, be online, have some kind of social media, maybe Twitter, follow people, follow agents, follow whatever, because you don't know who might contact you at a different, at a time where you've been longlisted or shortlisted and you might have some interest. It's, I think that's definitely worthwhile.
Yeah. You also received funding from the Arts Council Ireland to write the book. Obviously, it's a hugely complicated process for applying for funding, but I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about kind of how that funding supported you.
Yeah, money is always good, isn't it? What does money buy us? Money buys us time, and money buys us trying not to worry too much about it. I mean, I feel incredibly lucky that I was able to get to a point where I could even consider, you know, taking the time, full time, to work on the novel. And definitely having the Arts Council grant, my grant was €5,000, which definitely helped to take stress, I guess, away of feeling like you're investing in something. Both, I mean, in the early days, you're investing financially in something too, because you're not doing other work. So you would really need to be able to feel that you're not digging too big a hole for yourself. It helped massively, yeah, in terms of life expenses. And I don't know, do you have an equivalent in the UK?
Yeah, there's well, there's an Arts Council England. And I know just from speaking to various people who have applied for it, it's incredibly complicated to apply, but obviously very worthwhile doing so. And I think there's two different types of funding you can apply for. One is something like Finding Your Practice, and the other one is, I have no idea what it's called, but they're very, you know, very involved in terms of you have to lay out what you would use the money for. And I'm sure it's very similar to Arts Council Ireland, but I have never looked into it just because the thought of it is terrifying, but but I know it's very rewarding, and I'm sure that for, particularly if you're doing like a very expensive research trip, or you need to go and, I don't know, go to Glasgow and look up something really important, then I'm sure that the funding would help massively. It's I think in a way, I think sometimes the application process is almost off-putting, so off-putting that people don't do it, but I think, well, myself included, but obviously it's a really important thing to do if you know, you feel that support would benefit you.
Yeah, and it's something to get help with too, isn't it? I know the Arts Council is quite good here in terms of having seminars, you know, where you can go and you can ask questions, or you can see what the how to apply, or to make the process seem simpler. I think also, if you know people who've applied successfully before, it's always a good idea maybe to see if they would share their application with you. Not that you find anything earth shattering in there, but sometimes somebody just approaches something in a much simpler way than you did. Or, I mean, this is you don't know what you'll discover, I suppose, is what I'm saying. But it's definitely a good idea to get help with that, and to see if you can have a look at what a successful application has looked at. I would definitely do that.
Yeah.
And Ireland also has a pilot program for basic income for the arts at the moment. I don't know if you've heard about that.
Mm-hmm.
That if it's successful, people will be able to apply for, yeah, basic income to remain working in the arts and not abandoning the arts, because you just cannot make ends meet. So if that works out, hopefully it will, there be a, you know, very meaningful support for people in Visual arts, music, dance, architecture, circus, all kinds of
Yeah, that'd be
arts.
amazing.
Yeah, imagine that. So yeah, the pilot program is at the moment, and they have a control group as well for people who are not receiving the money to see how that might be working for them. And I'm in the control group, so I'm giving my feedback about how great it would be maybe to have more support
Money, yeah.
when you have a two-book deal and you're going to have to deliver that book. So there's a limited amount of time that you can spend on other work. All the support for the arts is just becoming more and more important, really, I think. So it's really been wonderful to see.
So I'd love to hear a little bit more about your journey throughout publishing. So from, I guess, the moment you signed your contract to now. And I was wondering if there's anything you've experienced in that time that you found particularly difficult or challenging, and how you think you would advise the next cohort of debut novelists. So let's say 2024's debut novelists who are out there, and I hope they're listening. What advice would you give to them?
Advice. Okay. Everybody, so I don't know if I have advice. I can say a little bit about my experience, I guess, and if anybody chimes with that, then either do the same or do something completely different than I did. I've had quite a good experience in terms of my publisher has been fantastic. They're great in terms of communication. Editing has been really great for me. I think the book has been published really nicely. So I've had, I think, as good an experience really as you can have. And I think I've been very fortunate, and the people I've been working with, everything has gone really, really nicely for me. That the actual process of coming up to publication, I think I found that quite intense too. Doing kind of the pieces of PR that I did were fine. I enjoyed them. It was all good. Everything was fine, but I got quite, I think the key kept winding and winding, I think, and the adrenaline kept going up and up, and there was no kind of release for a long time, and I did get very, very sick after the book came out. I had my launch, and I think I got sick about, 5 minutes after that, the germs, and I found it very hard to shake it off as well. So I definitely did not pace myself. I think I was kind of trying to push harder from inside myself to hope for a success or to make things happen in a way that really things that I just had no control over. I guess it's all part of just trying to do a good job too, isn't it? I just really wanted to try and do a good job of everything, and a lot of it was new to me too. I mean, you're sitting in at your desk and you're writing your book, and that's great. But then there's the shock being outside and talking to people and maybe doing an interview on live national radio or something that you're just not used to doing. You think they're mad for having you on without checking that you're kind of sane and have everything in order to begin with. It's lots of situations that you might not be used to. I'm determined kind of second time around to just not stress about that stuff. I guess that it's important, but it's not worth getting this big adrenaline build up. I think trying to have time to relax, is that the right word? Can you relax when you're going to publication? I'm not completely sure. Time to, perspective. Give yourself some breaks. Try not to be just 24/7 focused. Try not to make it your whole life, even if it is just for those few months.
Well, as you mentioned, second time round, finally, Aoife, can you tell us anything about what you're working on next?
Yes, I can tell you a certain amount. I can tell you that it is historical fiction. I'll be going a little bit further back in time. I think it's a companion to the first book in certain ways that, as you can tell, I'm not going to give you too much detail about it. In terms of, the first book, for example, I think is a little bit about women who are living within certain confines, kind of exploding within those confines. You know, this is, you're not allowed outside of these walls. So what you, if there's something that you need to accomplish, you have to accomplish it, I suppose, like Ginger Rogers was saying, backwards, but in heels. You know, you have all of these things that are working against you. How are you going to achieve what you want when you can't change those parameters? It's a companion, I think, for the first book in that sense. And I am writing about a female historical figure.
Oh, very intriguing. Well, I can't wait to find out more about what this next book is going to be. But Aoife, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, Chloe, you're so brilliant. Thank you for having me.
That was Aoife Fitzpatrick talking about her historical novel, The Red Bird Sings, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it'd be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.